from deep inside your radio.
Back at the Le Show Dome, ladies and gentlemen, where it was meant to be. And first up, just cleaning up some old business, something you might have missed, something I didn't miss but just had lingering around until this very special day. Remember Bernard Kerik? He was the former police commissioner of New York who was George W. Bush's first choice to succeed Tom Ridge as director of Homeland Security to protect us, ladies and gentlemen. You may be wondering what he's been up to since he had to withdraw his nomination out of terminal embarrassment. According to the New York Daily News, he accepted thousands of dollars in royalties from a book published to raise money for the families of heroes killed on 9/11. Kerik contributed an 11-sentence foreword to the book of photographs entitled In the Line of Duty, in which he praised police and firefighters who, quote, desperately fought and struggled and bled and died in a noble effort. Theirs is a story beyond words, a story of bravery, fidelity, and sacrifice, a story that must never be forgotten, Kerik wrote. Kerik's royalties for those 11 sentences have so far totaled $75,954.52. The deal came about when Kerik was engaged in a torrid year-long affair with the book's publisher, Judith Regan. Former Fire Commissioner Thomas von Essen, who also wrote an introduction to the book, accepted no money. He directed Regan Books to include his payment in its charitable donation. Kerik was paid, according to the publisher, but they declined to cite the amount, claiming there's a company policy. Is that the same company policy against announcing the advances of spectacular new books coming out? I don't know. Asked about the royalties, Kerik spokesman Robert Leonard said the city's former top cop has donated far more to charity. Leonard said Kerik paid income taxes on the royalties. Well, can we get a cake for the man? Can we send cards, please? Because he paid income taxes on his income. All right, then. And has donated $150,000 to charitable causes, including $50,000 to groups that help the families of cops and firefighters. Well, that's only $25,000 less than he took in royalties from the book. Leonard declined to provide documents that would substantiate the numbers. The book's cover states publishers' profits will be donated to the New York Police and Fire Widows and Children's Benefit Fund. Regan Books has donated some $500,000 to the charity, continues to send checks and detailed accounting statements every 6 months, said the charity's treasurer, David Golish. He didn't know Kerik had received royalties. That's news to me, he said. News to everyone. Apparently not news to Kerik. Kerik's royalty checks were mailed to former Mayor Rudy Giuliani's consulting firm in the name of Griffin Strategic Group, a Delaware-based entity that Kerik created. The city... Bernie Kerik, ladies and gentlemen, he would have been head of Homeland Security, had just not some embarrassing stuff about his private life with Judith Regan, publisher of Regan Books, come to light. Their love nest was an apartment originally rented by the city for R&R for the heroes, the tuckered out police and firefighters of 9/11. It just gets better. Bernie Kerik, the gift that won't stop giving. Hello, welcome to the show.
Come on to my house, I'm going to give you candy. Come on to my house, I'm going to give you an apple, plum, and apricot too. Hey, come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, I'm going to give you figs and dates and grapes and a cake. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, come on. Come on to my house, got to give you shish kebab. Come on, 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 come on.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this very special. They're all very special, as you know, but this is so very special because it's today, and today is the most special day ever, because it's not yesterday or tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, so much to talk about that probably escaped most people's ken, if not yours, or your Barbie, for that matter, because the media were preoccupied with this week's remake of The In-Laws. But one thing that might have escaped your ken on that subject, this is by Thomas Mayo, Associate Professor of Law, Southern Methodist University, and also a professor at SMU Medical School. And this is about something else that happened this week. I'm quoting from him. This week, Sun Hudson, the nearly six-month-old at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston, diagnosed and slowly dying with a rare form of dwarfism, was taken off the ventilator that was keeping him alive. A Houston court authorized the hospital's action, and Sun died shortly thereafter. This is the first time in the United States, according to the Houston Chronicle and the Dallas Morning News, that a court has allowed life-sustaining treatment to be withdrawn from a pediatric patient over the objections of the child's parent. If true, the unique Texas statute under which this saga was played out contributed in no small way to the outcome. The writer is one of the law's co-authors. If an attending physician, he continues, disagrees with a surrogate over life-and-death treatment decisions, there must be an ethics committee consultation. In futility case such as Sun Hudson's, in which the treatment team is seeking to stop treatment deemed to be non-beneficial, if the ethics committee agrees with the team, the hospital will be authorized to discontinue the disputed treatment. These provisions, which were added to Texas law in 1999, originally applied only to adult patients. In 2003, they were made applicable to disputes over treatment decisions for on behalf of minors. One of the co-drafters in both laws, the professor notes, was the National Right to Life Committee. The bill passed both houses of the Texas legislature unanimously, and the 1999 law was signed into law by then-Governor George W. Bush. Enough of that story. Now, news that may have escaped your ken, news from outside the bubble, reactors in many British nuclear power stations are in danger of developing cracks in their graphite cores. This should force some plants to close down earlier than expected, dealing a blow to the idea that nuclear power can become a green option in the fight against global warming. Documents obtained by New Scientist under the UK's new Freedom of Information Act. Hey, welcome aboard, guys. Never too late to have a Freedom of Information Act, have revealed unsuspected problems with the country's aging advanced gas-cooled reactors. Government inspectors say they've uncovered weaknesses in the safety analysis carried out by the company that runs the reactors. Why would that be? Why would the company that runs the reactors have a motive in carrying out weak safety? Ladies and gentlemen. But now, more news from outside the bubble. The new British Freedom of Information Act is paying other dividends as well. The Attorney General of Great Britain is the gentleman who gives the government advice on whether what the government wants to do is legal. His name is Lord Goldsmith. He believed that invading Iraq without a second United Nations resolution would be illegal until shortly before the war started. This according to Elizabeth Wilmshurst, who was deputy legal advisor at the Foreign Office, until she quit because, in her opinion, the invasion was against international law. She revealed Lord Goldsmith's thinking in a section of her resignation letter, which became public thanks to the new Freedom of Information Act. She also suggested Lord Goldsmith changed his mind twice before advising Tony Blair that the original Security Council resolution could justify war. Many international lawyers insist that that resolution did not provide satisfactory legal justification for the war. See, the Brits are so quaint, they're still arguing about whether this is legal. We've moved on. they're so quaint that they're also worried about whether some of their troops could be prosecuted for war crimes for participating in something that might be defined as aggression. They're still looking into that stuff. Us, we're going a different way. The Senate Committee Overseeing U.S. Intelligence has shut down its investigation into whether top administration officials distorted intelligence evidence to build the case for war in Iraq. See, last July, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence released a 511-page report saying the intelligence community erroneously assessed Saddam Hussein's non-existent WMD programs in relationship to al-Qaeda. But there was a second part of the inquiry: how accurately the Bush administration represented the intelligence it possessed to the Congress and the public, and how appropriately administration policymakers influenced the assessment and presentation of intelligence within the government. The committee delayed that second report until after the November election because it was too potentially provocative and politically. Pat Roberts, the Senate Intelligence Committee chairman, said this week that second report will never happen. "It's basically on the back burner," he said, forgetting to add that there is no stove. The bottom line is the administration believed the intelligence, and the intelligence was wrong. That says Pat Roberts, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Roberts added the WMD Commission in March will lay it all out. That would be the commission President Bush appointed last February, and which doesn't look at policymakers' role in either intelligence production or the public presentation thereof. The back burner. And the of that WMD Commission's forthcoming report, spokesman Larry McQuillan says most of what it's found is not going to be released to the public. So relax, or move to Britain if you want to find out things. I wish we had a freedom of... The United States has committed grave violations of human rights against prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Who said that? I mean, aside from me here just now. Whom am I quoting? The Foreign Affairs Committee of Britain's Parliament. You know, I'm not sure that they're really with us. The report also called on the British government to make clear whether it uses intelligence passed on by other countries that may have been gathered by torturing suspects. Who would that be? The committee said it was surprising and unsettling that the government had twice failed to answer whether London receives information extracted under torture by a third country. Who would that be? Who are they looking at? Who are they winking at? Who are they pointing at? Britain, ladies and gentlemen. The country of Great Britain. More news you may have missed due to the in-laws. A terror suspect held at Guantanamo Bay helped Osama bin Laden escape his mountain hideout at Tora Bora in 2001, according to a U.S. government document. The document provided in response to a Freedom of Information request. Hey! Says the unidentified detainee assisted in the escape of Osama bin Laden from Tora Bora. It's the first definitive statement from the Pentagon that bin Laden was at Tora Bora and evaded a U.S. pursuit there. The detainee is not identified by name or nationality, but he had bodyguards and collaborated with regional al-Qaeda leadership. He was one of Osama bin Laden's commanders during the Soviet jihad, meaning when we were paying for Osama bin Laden to go into Afghanistan against the Russians. So he was there. We missed him. No news, I guess. Damning evidence of American soldiers abusing detainees at an... Oh, wait a minute. We have to have music for this, I think. Do we? Well, I'll get to it. No, well, I think we're ready now. Yes. Who am I talking to? I'm talking to myself, ladies and gentlemen. Here's the music for our next little featurette.
It's just a few bad apples messing up the bunch. A few bad apples bringing up your lunch.
Yeah, because otherwise it would get too depressing. Damning evidence of American soldiers abusing detainees at another prison in Iraq was made public this week It details how prisoners were systematically and intentionally mistreated at the military base in Mosul, culminating in the death of one. Nobody was court-martialed over the abuse. You can't court-martial apples. An investigation by a U.S. officer after a prisoner's jaw was broken found that inmates were hit with water bottles, made to do exhausting physical exercises until they collapsed, deprived of sleep, subjected to deafening heavy metal music, thank you very much, and had cigarette smoke blown into sandbags they were forced to wear as hoods. One soldier said troops always harass the hell out of detainees. In December 2003, a prisoner died after 4 days of continuous punishment. Mistreatments were not confined to Abu Ghraib. Just some bad apples, ladies and gentlemen. Some more bad apples. Good crop. Good crop. We got a good crop going. A military tribunal determined last fall that Murat Kurnaz, a German national seized in Pakistan in 2001, was a member of Al-Qaeda and an enemy combatant whom the government could detain indefinitely at Guantanamo Bay. The three military officers on the panel, of course their identities are kept secret, said in papers filed in federal court, they reached their conclusion based largely on classified evidence that was too sensitive to release to the public. That evidence, recently declassified and now obtained by the Washington Post, shows that U.S. military intelligence and German law enforcement authorities had largely concluded there was no information that linked Kurnaz to Al-Qaeda, any other terrorist organization, or to terrorist activities. A federal judge in January criticized the military panel for ignoring the exculpatory information that dominates Kurnaz's file and for relying instead on a brief, unsupported memo filed shortly before his hearing by an unidentified government official. He's been detained at Guantanamo Bay since at least January 2002. This appears to be the first in which classified material considered by one of those tribunals has become public. Now we know why. And, ladies and gentlemen, news about the new Iraq, for your listening pleasure, says Dr. Tasa Kasim, the cases we're getting are unbelievable. Huge crimes, assassinations, beheadings. Why, only today I dissected three beheaded bodies. We will probably break the record for beheaded cadavers in any forensic department in the world. He's a doctor in a hospital in Baghdad. A killing epidemic, according to the Los Angeles Times, has taken hold. Of Iraq. Ministry of Health statistics showed that record numbers of Iraqi citizens are coming to violent ends. Assassinations and bombings have garnered worldwide attention, but Iraqi officials say violence unrelated to the insurgency is growing. The motives are so opaque they cannot tell, the authorities say, whether they are investigating a crime disguised as an act of war or a political assassination masquerading as a business dispute. 8,000 deaths by unnatural causes in 2004, up from 6,000 the previous year. In the final year of Saddam's regime, the morgue got 1,800 bodies total. 60% of the deaths are now caused by gunshot wounds. Most are unrelated to the insurgency. Most is inspired by the ethnic, tribal, and religious rivalries that were held in check by Hussein's brutal rule and now facilitated by a ready supply of firearms. You're welcome. Says Lieutenant Faris Jubrail of the Baghdad police, the only virtue of the old regime is that Iraq enjoyed a state of stability. It was a reaction to the huge size of punishment that the regime would practice. This would never have happened then. Police say they're also growing increasingly worried about the recent arrival of organized criminal groups who trade in arms, drugs, and stolen cars and blackmail people. In some cases, insurgents have paid gangs of thugs to kidnap doctors and engineers or to kill barbers for giving Western-style haircuts. The new Iraq. By the way, a story many might have missed, the at least attempted revolution in Kyrgyzstan this week. Little trouble maintaining stability in the capital and organizing a new government, which is described in wire reports as signs of crisis. We have that report from Baghdad about the security problem. And the government, well, the election that was held January 30th, in Iraq, you remember that. They've yet to organize the government. But that's not a crisis. That's good progress. Ladies and gentlemen, it should come as no news to you that we've been featuring on this broadcast last couple weeks. Highlights from Dan Rather's storied broadcasting career. But it's time to turn our attention to the present, to at least one person who's still on the air, although it's cable, so he's not really technically on air. He's on wire. Forget it. It may not come as news to you that an anchor for the Fox News Channel makes a factual error, or that he hates his liberal guest, but count the number of times he says, in fact.
Welcome back to Hannity and Combs. I'm Sean Hannity. I am outside of the hospice where Terry Schiavo is right now. Now, Fox News can now report, in fact, that, and you are looking there at the Supreme Court of the United States, that in fact the petition by the Schindler family on behalf of Terry Schiavo can in fact be filed at the Supreme Court, that building you're looking at right now, as early as tonight. 12 men and women may ultimately have Terry Schiavo's life in their hands. We're going to continue to watch and wait and monitor what's going on at that building throughout the evening right here on the Fox News Channel. What did I say? Oh, did I say 12? Oh, I'm sorry. What was I thinking? What's 12? Something's 12. Yeah. I'm going to correct it. I will. I got to. I'll do it. If you look right there, that's the Supreme Court of the United States. I accidentally referred to the 12 members of the 11th Circuit earlier. But as early as tonight, Fox News can report that, in fact, the appeal could be filed at that building, and those nine men and women that work at that Supreme Court could, in fact, rule in this case. Hey, Finley, when I may speak like that, you got to correct me. Thanks. Congressman's next. This is the one negative guy. I'm going to pound him, too, like this other guy. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, Congressman. Jerk. Jim Moran. I forget where he's from. Where's he from, Finley? He wanted to talk about Medicare. Good God.
What a jerk. Did you hear that, Frank? Asshole.
God, I hate these people. You have no idea. It's unbelievable to me. How pissed was Moran? Not that I give a shit. I have always couldn't stand this guy.
You say the world is mad. You say that you've been had. You don't like your part in the floor show. You say it's all a bust. There's no one you can trust. Well, tell me something that I don't know. Say the world's a mess, it's anybody's guess as to who will deliver that low blow. You suffer from the strain, you don't dig pain. Well, tell me something that I don't know. Thank you. mistake. You didn't get your break. You don't see the magic in the moon glow. Your life is incomplete. You're on a one-way street. Well, tell me something that I don't know. You're uptight. It ain't right. Tell me something that I don't know.
Time now for Dr. Manfred Weitzner and the Health File. Dr. Weitzner is both a doctor and an attorney, so if he sues himself, he wins. Now, Dr. Weitzner.
Thank you, Tim, and welcome again, dear listeners, to the sprawling exurban landscape of the Health File. And you know, friends, I've been getting asked all week long, Dr. Weitzner, what do you think should happen in the case of Terry Schiavo, the poor young woman who appears to be in a persistent vegetative state? And here's what I've said. If a vegetative state is good enough for vegetables, it may well be good enough for you and me. But ultimately, that's up to the docs involved. What I can say without fear of contraindication is that a case like Terry should be treated with megadoses of vitamin L for love, vitamin H for hope, and most important of all, vitamin I for insurance.
You're listening to Dr. Manfred Weitzner and the Health File. You can text message comments to Dr. Weitzner, but under no circumstances can you be added to his buddy list. Once again, Dr. Weitzner.
Thank you, Tim. We'll all be watching for you in the Redondo Beach Little Theater production of Mark Twain Tonight. Tim will be playing the role of Hal Holbrook. My friends, as the Terry Schiavo case winds towards its almost inevitable conclusion, anxious cable viewers are turning to the medical profession for answers the docs just can't provide with certainty. At least most docs can't, but there are new tools coming along that allow those of us who labor in the verdant fields of the Health File to be far more certain of what we think we think. At least that's the contention of my guest today. He's professor of faith-based medicine at Jim Huckabee University in Anniston, Alabama, Dr. Alan Boyce. Dr. Boyce, welcome to the probing embrace of the Health File.
Thank you, Dr. Weitzner. It's a blessing to be here.
Well, let's withhold that particular judgment until we see whether the parking people honor your validation. Dr. Boyce, you're a practitioner of what you've termed the Bill Frist School of Medicine. What exactly does that entail?
Well, as you know, most people became aware of this particular branch of the medical family when Senator Frist, whom we still think of as Dr. Frist in the faith-based medical community, announced his diagnosis of Terry Schiavo's condition based on his viewing of some videotape of her.
It was about an hour, as I recall.
Well, however much it was, Dr. Weitzner, it was a blessing. Mm-hmm. Had Terry suffered something like a bulimia-induced heart episode a century ago, still black and white photographs would be the closest we could have come to allowing every citizen to diagnose her for him or herself.
Well, from that standpoint, a blessing indeed. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Boyce, there's been a certain amount of grumbling among the more conventionally credentialed inhabitants of the Health File regarding the reliability of diagnosis via videotape. No. For example, if I presented with a skin lesion, video wouldn't necessarily allow you to discern its texture or its dimensions. It could be a benign keratosis or a malignant melanoma as far as the camera is concerned, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm glad you framed that as a question, Dr. Weitzner, because even though we would always love to have MRIs or EEGs or whatever you call them, the existence of videotape and our ability to sit there and watch it again, and watch it in slow-mo and rewind it and everything. You just can't do that with a so-called reality-based patient experience.
Well, Doctor, just for the more skeptical among those who huddle inside the protective broadcast penumbra of the Health File, Jim Huckabee University is accredited?
Oh, yes, sir. It's accredited by the Bob Jones Accreditation Institute. That's the gold standard of faith-based accreditation.
All right, so when you are denied the opportunity to palpate and so forth with a living, breathing patient, and what you're examining instead is an image on the TV screen, what are the possible limitations on your diagnosing acuity?
Well, I think Dr. Frist pioneered in the use of brightness and sharpness controls to give the examining physician a far sharper and, yes, a brighter view of the patient. Mm-hmm. Again, if you were to examine the patient in so-called person, you're limited by the visual conditions of that particular facility.
Yeah.
So I think I speak for many of us in the blessing-based medical community when I say that, as Fristians, we believe the video examination is superior.
Now, of course, just to be sure we're all on the same page here in the ream of stationery inside the hanging folder of the Health File, these video examinations, unlike videos we might watch in our homes, don't have commercials or previews of coming attractions, so there's no question of distraction or the loss of concentration, anything that might rattle the doc.
No, sir. These are home-shot tapes, and one thing you realize as you labor in the vineyard of Fristian video diagnosis is just how good so many of God's children have gotten in the framing, the lighting, the shooting of home video.
So no camera shaking, no in and out of focus.
Dr. Whiteson, we don't even see those in videos we receive from sub-equatorial countries. So the blessings of good camera work have have indeed been sown as seeds on the wind.
And that's a good way of sowing blessings?
Oh, it is indeed.
Still, there are those within the more reality-based precincts of conventional medicine who, while denying the mind-body connection, still protest that video images are only two-dimensional, while the actual body enjoys at least three.
Well, this is why it's such a gift to be alive in these days, Dr. Weitzner. Already, high-definition cameras are becoming commonplace as we experience the digital video revolution. These are images so clear and so crisp that they'll actually allow us to read the nurse's name badge from 25 feet away.
And that's a good thing?
Oh, it's just the beginning. I think God has in mind for us 3D HD, and with tools like that, I believe we'll be able to perform diagnoses that will literally take your breath away.
Well, not literally. That would require ventilators, wouldn't it?
I suppose for the language-based, that would be correct.
Dr. Boyce, have you actually performed a Fristian diagnosis yourself and developed a course of treatment based on it? I think that would be of great interest to our fellow denizens of the Health File.
I haven't really, Dr. Weitzner, but I did get the opportunity to see Dr. Frist's video diagnosis of Mrs. Shivo on videotape. I know this has been a stressful situation for the senator, too, but I've never seen him look better. He looks relaxed. He looks youthful and healthy.
A state we all aspire to inside the aspirational brackets of the Health File. Dr. Boyce, thank you so much for dropping by and informing us about Fristian diagnosis. It looks like another reason not to throw away the television set.
Oh, it was my blessing.
And so, friends, time too quickly brings this program to its terminal state, wishing you loads of vitamin S. See you next week. I'm Dr. Manfred Weitzner, escorting you out through the Manila doorway of the Health File. So long.
I'm gonna be around my vegetables. I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you. My favorite vegetable. If you brought a big brown bag of them home, I'd jump up and down and hope you'd toss me a carrot. I'm gonna keep well my vegetables, car off and sell my vegetables. I love you most of all. My
favorite vegetable. I tried to kick the ball, but my chenny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Well, Daddy says, sleep a lot, eat a lot, brush 'em like crazy.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Tales of Airport Security. It's a copyrighted feature. It's exciting already. This is from Bernie in Philadelphia. Dear Harry, returning to JFK from Prague last week. Oh, lucky man. With my friend Laszlo, I was selected to have my checked luggage hand-searched. Laszlo was not selected. I was not permitted to use my cell phone to call my friend to tell him why I was delayed. An Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, part of Homeland Security, officer asked me several questions about my trip and its purpose. He then had me put my bag up on a table and asked me to open it. He started pulling out numerous items, asking what they were. Among them, a radio scanner, my backup Swiss Army knife, an 18th century Czech jewelry box, and dozens of music CDs, including an apparently very suspicious-looking road case, a box set of Plastic People of the Universe CDs, Václav Havel's favorite band. The officer said that he'd never heard of them and started asking me questions about the band. He'd never heard of Václav Havel either. After that, he asked me questions about the conference I'd been attending, which he said he'd never heard of. I explained that it's the world's largest information technology and telecom technology conference and trade show. And he asked me if any satellite TV companies were there. I said yes. And he asked if any of them had anything to do with Nagravision. I said yes. Nagravision is one of the most widely used satellite signal encryption systems in the world. Then he asked me if I knew how to hack Nagravision. I told him no, and asked him why he wanted to know. He said that he has a free-to-air satellite receiving system and that he enjoys watching soccer and other international programming, but that some of it is scrambled, and he wanted to know how to get it for free. I told him that was probably illegal, but the people were probably working on cracking the encryption if there was a market demand from people like him. He looked at me strangely, then told me to pick up my bag and leave. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen. That, why wouldn't you copyright that feature? You know, if it was up to you. If it were up to you, is what I meant to say. Ladies and gentlemen, the Government Accountability Office will investigate the Bush administration's practice of paying journalists to support administration policies. The GAO will look into Health and Human Service Department's payments to Maggie Gallagher. She was a columnist on the subject of marriage, and the department paid her to support some policy that they thought was cool. Real cool. Two Democratic senators called for the investigation, claiming the payments were an illegal use of taxpayer dollars. The White House responded, the president has made it clear there must be a bright line between advocacy and journalism. But Bill Pierce, spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services, responded this way. He would not say that there are no longer journalists on the payroll. He said it's surprising GAO would spend taxpayer money on this when there are real issues like Social Security and health care that need attention. Oh, he wanted to talk about Medicare, huh? Interesting. When asked for details on whether the department had any journalists on its payroll, he echoed White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan, who in the case of Jeff Gannon, the blogger for a Republican-owned website, who had gotten a daily press pass into the White House for nearly 2 years to sit in at White House briefings and news conferences, McClellan said, well, we don't really know at this point what a journalist is. Bill Pierce, the spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Service, Health and Human Services, simply asked, in response to the question, do you have any journalists on your payroll? Quote, what is a journalist? Unquote. So, thought we'd ask the caser to help him out.
What is a journalist? He's a hard-drinking, soft-spoken, burn-up-some-shoe-leather, but sit-on-his-hiney sort of son of a gun, or daughter of a gun, who's seen it all before and can't wait to see it all again. A journalist is someone who gets shot at in a war zone so that he can report back material that can't be broadcast because it might be too disturbing. A journalist is someone who reads teleprompter better than anybody and writes better than the guy who just won the Pulitzer. Journalists like deadlines, bylines, a bigger news hole, free food. Journalists don't like deadlines, editors, cramped press facilities at major news events, media whores. Journalists like to know, how does it feel, and what's the mood here? Journalists don't like to know how the Social Security system really works. A journalist is often found at news conferences, presidential visits, crime scenes, hospice vigils, and the sites of major recent snowfalls. A journalist is seldom found advertising his services on a website for gay escorts. Journalists sometimes make too much money getting out of the studio too seldom so they can mingle with other journalists who are resentful because they never get into the studio at all. Journalists can be anchors, but never sales. They can be reporters or just repeaters. A journalist looks down on celebrities until the day he becomes one. A journalist spends too much time covering a story that gets too little space so it can be skimmed by a reader with too little time. Journalists can't resist miracle puppies, children trapped in wells, killer bees. Journalists almost always resist stories with three or more sides, computer terminals without a Nexus account, angles that might make their colleagues think they're flaky. A journalist will fly halfway around the world to stand where a tsunami took place, and he'll stand in freezing rain for 2 hours to point out that it's winter time. Journalists are more curious than anybody, attacked by everybody, and lent money by nobody. A journalist will share a quote, but won't reveal a source. A journalist thinks the First Amendment is the only one the founders really meant. What is a journalist? A journalist is someone who earned pretty good money telling us what was really going on in the world, until he realized he could earn better money by telling us about the social lives of the people who earn really great money, telling us fairy tales about the world. A journalist knows
Who's got the best Rolodex? Who's got the best satellite phone circuits? How much backlight he needs? A journalist doesn't know where to find Kyrgyzstan on a map, where to find the smart people in a small town, how you're supposed to fit a 5-minute story into a 90-second hole. A journalist is just like the rest of us, except he's more tenacious, lazier, sloppier, got better hair, and does his best work in the comfort of the herd. What is a journalist? Next time you see one, just ask him, how does it feel?
Thank you, Casey. And now news about somebody who owns journalists. Our good friend Rupert Murdoch. This from the Australian Sydney Morning Herald. Rupert Murdoch reportedly, now he's a conservative, he's entitled to do this, I think, he reportedly avoided paying stamp duty of $41 million and capital gains tax of $92 million by moving control of his ultimate family company. This is what's behind the scenes of News Corp, a company called Kyarem, to the Caribbean and listing it on the Bermuda Stock Exchange. This took place a week before News Corp was reincorporated in the United States last November. Documents show that listing Kyarem in the tax haven allowed the Murdoch family to obtain a tax benefit. Well, of course. This was part of a complicated series of deals around the world in which the Murdochs moved control of their shareholding and $40 million in cash to Reno, Nevada. Kyarem, in case you're looking it up, was renamed Carl Holt last October. A month after this transaction, Murdoch reportedly bought a 20-room Manhattan apartment on Central Park for $56 million. So he needed the money for a roof over his head. News of the Digital Wonderland, American Idol executive producer Ken Warwick called rubbish the suggestions by hardcore Idol fans on the web that this week's mix-up in voting was deliberate. Why would we contaminate the honesty of the top-rated show in America by fiddling with it, he asked rhetorically during a phone call with reporters. The mix-up in information on how to vote was the result, he said, of human error. In answer to the very first question he got from reporters, how did this happen, he explained that the producers had sync problems on the show the previous week. That doesn't mean they were throwing up into it. It means synchronization. They went to HD this season. You take your eye off one ball, he said, and it slipped through. So, news of the Digital Wonderland, ladies and gentlemen. Voting disruption caused by sync problems as American Idol goes digital. Won't you? Well, no time for apologies of the week this week. We'll hold the best ones to next week. But that is the conclusion of this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, on channel 108 at Sirius Satellite Radio, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it on your computer, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, and now available as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow. And it would be just like Rupert Murdoch being able to avoid even more tax indebtedness if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? All righty. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. One more item we do have time for. For 3 months, the federal government didn't disclose that over 4 years, genetically modified corn seed was sold accidentally to some U.S. farms and may have gotten into the American food supply. Have a nice week. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. Le Show playlists available at harryshearer.com. Oh, yeah, and that whole list of things, ways you can get this broadcast, I forgot to mention, we're now being podcast via kcrw.com. Gentlemen, start your pods. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.